these last several weeks of readings from Paul's letter to the Christians in Corinth makes you wonder just what was going on in that city, doesn't it? I mean, a couple weeks ago, Paul was warning those Corinthians about the effects of joining members with prostitutes. And last week, he was telling men that even if they had wives, to act as if they had none. Now, to be clear, that means to be celibate. Paul is very wary of marriage. Now, this week, reading and counsel to the Christian community is not quite as colorful as the last few, but truth be told, I think we're still left with some questions. Among them, who were these idols, and why did they need so much food? And even if people did eat the food sacrificed to these idols, why would this matter? Is this really worthy of a whole chapter of the letter? As is often the case, a little context is helpful. Scholars tell us that Corinth was well known in the first century as a quintessential pagan town. These are the good old days. Part of what this meant was that there was such a pantheon of gods in Corinth, and that all of these gods required the sacrifice of various animals on such a regular basis that the extra meat from all of these ceremonies was sold in the markets of the city. In addition, there was enough meat so that this meat was also served at the social clubs and the guilds that met in these temples around town. So sacrificial food was everywhere. It was woven into the fabric of the culture. Now, buying this meat in the marketplace or even eating it at a feast held by one of the guilds didn't mean that one was worshiping the god that demanded this sacrifice. Did it? This is the question that Paul is attempting to sort out in this, his eighth chapter in the first letter to the Corinthians. From what we can gather, in this Christian community, it seems that the eating of sacrificial food was an issue for some, but not all, of its members. It's likely that many had no qualms at all about eating this meat, and as they didn't acknowledge that the gods that led to this animal's ritual killing were real. But this feeling wasn't universal. Whether because they were newer as Christ believers or because of their previous involvement in those pagan beliefs, there were some in this Christian community in Corinth who struggled deeply with this practice. I wonder, in reading this, I really wonder if this struggle may have been in part because eating that food in the temple or elsewhere might have pulled them back into old patterns. Right? After giving themselves over to this new way of being, this new way of believing, that this food held a kind of a power, a sway over them that they found hard to shake. Have you ever felt the pull of an old habit? An interior tug to a way that you have lived but wish to live no longer? It's my sense that this is what some of those Corinthians were battling. And like all old habits, it was something fierce. The first time that I remember encountering this particular text, the eighth chapter of 1 Corinthians, and I mean really getting it like it was talking directly to me, was almost 20 years ago. I was one of the leaders of a young adult community meeting in the East Bay. We met weekly on Tuesday nights. We checked in with one another, broke into discussion groups about the things that really mattered in our lives. Then we closed in prayer for one another and for all those in our lives in need of grounding and support. Over time, this group grew and formed into a real community, something kind of like a house church, with about 20 or 30 of us meeting every week. We were all in our early 20s. And it became so woven into our lives that we began to do what humans do, which is to gather socially, right? Barbecues and birthday parties and the like. And being that we were in our early 20s, these events often involved alcohol and merrymaking, though animals were rarely sacrificed. It was after some time, I really don't know how long, but sometime that the priest who was serving as a mentor to our community, that she and I had a discussion about having alcohol at these social events. The conversation was not about risk management. Thank God it had more substance than that. No, it was more about awareness and about the practice of a kind of active corporate love that I was beginning to learn about. And so part of the way into the conversation, this mentor suggested that we might stop serving alcohol at our events. Now, God's honest truth, I had turned 21 within that last year or so, and I could finally drink legally, and was now being told, well, really asked, to refrain from what felt like an inalienable right that had been granted to me by the Creator, or by the Founding Fathers, or by some other such authority. But I'm fine, I told this priest. I can do this. The people who are here, we can do this. I mean, for all intents and purposes, we are adults, right? Well, yes, he replied, and many of you probably can drink at these events without a problem. But not all of you can. You see, at least one of the members of our community, I'll call her Marie, struggled with addiction. She'd been fighting those demons since she was in middle school, sometimes more successfully than others, and she kept up a really good front. At these events, she sometimes drank, sometimes not. But for her, where she was in her life, well, being at those gatherings sometimes made it really hard to walk the line. And so wouldn't you know, in the course of this conversation with this mentor about drinking alcohol and being in community, out came 1 Corinthians chapter 8. My mentor then explained to me those very problems that some in the Corinthian community faced with sacrificial food. And then she explained how Paul appealed to them all. As the New Testament scholar Matt Skinner describes it, Paul saw around him a world that had all sorts of things outside of our control, which might seem familiar. But one of the few things that Paul saw that we can control is the way that we are with those whom he called weak believers, right? Those around us on this journey who are stumbling, those who are having trouble keeping their proverbial feet under them. And so one of the ways that we are to live together, Paul wrote, one of the ways that we can build up one another through love to limit our own freedom, limit our own authority, limit our own agency, all for the sake of the other. It may not be a challenge for you, he says, but that which is easy for you could be the very obstacle that keeps that other person from being able to stay strong. Right, as you read through this letter, the way that Paul describes the practice of eating meat, that it has nothing to do with the one true God, you might expect him to then say, therefore, eat away. But that's not where he ends his appeal. He ends his appeal asking for solidarity with those who are most vulnerable. Right? I could drink alcohol and still make good decisions, still be in right relationship with God and those around me, But that wasn't all that mattered, because my drinking alcohol was like placing stones in the path of my friend Marie. Sure, I could walk that path safely, but could she? It was through that conversation that we began to change how we gathered as a group. I began talking about what was really most important for us as members of one body. In a culture that places the rugged individual upon the highest pinnacle, this notion that we are to willingly limit our desires, our possibilities, our very selves, in order to aid the other, is like fighting uphill. Right? You can hear this strain, especially in some of our national discourse. This sense that we are to sacrifice or to limit ourselves for another who may be weaker, financially or otherwise, this is anathema. This idea of limits being beneficial runs counter to much of our culture right now. I mean, think about the recent fascination with Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged. And yet, friends, it is my belief that this way of acting out of compassionate love for another actually serves as antidote to that which ails us. For it is when we are willing to be with another in their struggle, right, and put that at the same level as our own desires, that we can be as a body rather than simply as a group of individuals. And so I wonder this morning, what is it that has power over me, over you? What is it that has power over those around us? In your family, at your work, in the cafeteria, at lunch, in the city, this Bay Area? What is it that makes us and makes those around us stumble? Because this morning, Paul appeals to us, as he does the sisters and brothers in Corinth, for us to remove the stones that make others stumble. Through sacrifice, by giving something of value, our own agency, for something of even greater value, the well-being of our brothers and sisters who would otherwise stumble. And maybe in a way that you and I exercise our rights. It may be in the ways that we use our money. It may be in the ways that we call power to question. But until all can walk this path freely, we must be ready to walk it side by side with everyone, removing the stones along the way.